I wanted to thank the team, which you'll find throughout the room. If the note takers could just put up their hands. This is a group of students and colleagues and staff members who volunteered to come and take notes. They will come armed with electronic technology, and that's because we want to gather the information and we will be consolidating it and actually posting it on the website so that it will be more widely available. We've been trying to record it. I also wanted to say thank you to the organizing team, and they're also spread out throughout the room. Would you mind just standing up if you're on the organizing committee? And there's Adam over there as well. It was a really large group, and it was a huge effort. And for the people who were closely involved in working on it, and it involved a lot of extra hours, Wendy Owens, Scott Kushner over there, and Aaron Manette, huge thanks. You know, many celebrations this weekend. So I'd like to turn it over for closing remarks to the provost.
Thank you. Can I use this? I have a microphone. Thank you very much. Some colleagues wondered why I was enthusiastic about sponsoring a conference on academic freedom. The simple answer is that I believe fundamentally that it is a core value of academic life and the cornerstone of the university. So I was happy to have the opportunity to sponsor this conference, but it was organized by a group of people who took the interest in both inviting speakers and in organizing their own thoughts about what it is. I started this afternoon by saying I believe fundamentally that the adjective matters and that it is academic freedom that we were talking about and not all democratic freedoms. Academic freedom cannot circumscribe those democratic freedoms. In fact, it should be a profound expansion of them into things in academic in the academy that are not usually tolerated elsewhere, including the ability to criticize the administration. This is an important and fundamental part of what academic freedom is. We purposely brought together people from different backgrounds and from different areas of the campus because one of the things I've learned in the last 7 years as the provost of McGill is that we don't know each other particularly well. Many people on the quadrangle, arts and sciences in particular, are sometimes isolated from the kinds of things that go on in what is sometimes referred to in medicine as the upper campus. So we really needed to bring some people together who thought and think about things in a different way, and I think that the perspectives we heard today really reinforce the importance of that kind of a conversation taking place. There are different styles of scholarship, there are different types of research, there are different ways to think about the relationship to graduate students and to our undergraduate curriculum. Let me just try to summarize some of the things I think we learned today. First, it's very clear that the predominant view is, and one that I do share, is that individual rights and privileges in teaching and research for professors is the fundamental core of academic freedom, but that it also comes with duties and responsibilities and obligations. You can't have one without the other, but the individual is the cornerstone of this. Research is fundamental to universities as we understand them and as McGill compares itself to its peers. A research-driven university should be fundamentally driven by curiosity-based research. But as we just heard in one of the interventions, increasingly, governments are driving agendas in which funding is not coming to curiosity-based research predominantly, but rather is being targeted. These are things that the university needs to work with its professors on in making sure that the granting agencies and public policy are informed by what it means to be a research university and why curiosity-driven research is so fundamental. But in addition to that, we also come into obstacles that we face every day in trying to protect academic freedom. If we're guided by a strong sense of integrity and a commitment to academic professional standards and ethics, and that should not be narrowly interpreted to mean the confines of a specific discipline, but a general approach to the academic life, then it does depend on the adjudication of our peers. It does depend on having the individual professor at the center of academic freedom. But all of the constraints that we heard And maybe I hear what I want to hear. I've sometimes been accused of that. The context, however, is very important. Universities exist in a larger context in which their autonomy is challenged every single day. It comes from governments because governments fund universities. I'm fundamentally convinced that notwithstanding what we heard about the small percentage of operating budget that now characterizes state universities in the United States, that they still fundamentally depend on public funding for their activities. They always talk about operating budget. What about the capital budgets and state appropriations and bond issues? What about the fact that in order for the research enterprise to be conducted, they all are directly tethered to Washington, D.C. for most of their funding? So these are really important considerations in terms of an external context in which there are no private universities and we're all publicly purposed, but we have to have institutions that can stand up and defend academic freedom, and that depends on having autonomy from the state, but autonomy from a group of other actors as well. That means we have to have a robust framework of rules and regulations at the university that protect professors, graduate students, students, and others who engage in research that's sponsored by someone else, besides those granting agencies and when they involve industry partners in particular. We really do need to make sure that our intellectual property policies, our commercialization approach, our way of thinking about the rights of publication are all protected. I think it's important as well to remember that the government interferes with the way, or would like to interfere with the way in which the university is funded, because it has a formula for determining which disciplines get which amounts of money. One arts student, I'll do it the other way around. One agriculture student is apparently worth 4.5 art students. And that's how funding comes into the university. It's fundamentally driven by a cost factor weighting. The university, we make decisions that transfer money from some areas of the university to others. We engage in internal subsidization of a lot of activities. If we didn't, we wouldn't be teaching languages. We probably wouldn't have a classics department. We might not have some of the social science and humanities disciplines that presently exist. We do it by internally removing those barriers that the government put there about funding and having a mechanism in which we decide to do the funding in a different way. I think it's important to have a discussion about how that happens, and that's part of what a budgeting exercise is at the university. The third thing about the external constraints we have to remember, and we heard it very eloquently described in the panel that talked about professional orders, is that there is a continual battle that goes on between the institution and the professors who teach in those orders, but with the institution and the government, the Office of Professions, and the individual professional orders, because we think that while it's important for the university, for the orders to establish and protect the rights of individual citizens, the curriculum and those who teach it at universities should be fundamentally determined by the peer review system and by university autonomy and not dictated by professional orders. One that wasn't mentioned today, which is quite interesting, but I will touch on it, is philanthropy. Increasingly, the diversification of revenues coming into the university depends on philanthropic or foundations or individuals, and the extent to which they may exercise influence needs to be protected. That means we have to have the third element of the... So I do believe that it's individuals, but there has to be some protection of an autonomy of the institution in fighting against the external incursions to allow the individual freedom of professors to continue. I purposely eliminated it to professors in my own thinking. I heard more later about potential inclusions of others, but the fundamental values are research and teaching, and those are the activities that are inherent in the definition of a professor, along with service to the professional community and the community at large. The third thing in academic freedom is that we heard a lot about was collegiality and the ways in which consultations should take place and the ways in which we could collegially govern ourselves. Some of that collegial governance actually does already take place, and one of the interesting things that I heard today, and which we really do need to work on, is to make sure everyone knows what these entities actually do, how a Senate really works, and how it does have full and complete authority over any rule or regulation that affects academic employment. No administrator can take that away from Senate. It's Senate's prerogative to vote and to discuss and to write, in the final analysis, the rules and regulations that regulate academic employment. And that's where it should be. It should reside with the Senate. If its composition needs to be changed, if some of the terms of reference need to be changed, then it should come forward from that body. It is the collegial body that is responsible for administering the regulations and statutes of the university that determine and are based on academic freedom. We have really strong appeals processes here for all decisions that are ever taken, and they can be overturned. Administrative decisions can be overturned by an adjudication panel of peers, including negative tenure decisions. So the protections are there. We often don't talk about them, or we criticize them without knowing that they're there. I think it's important that we actually go back and look at what we can do. I do think the conversation has been engaged. I think this has been a very lively and interesting discussion this afternoon, but it is the first, I think, of a series of consultations that we'll need to undertake in order to understand the constituencies. It's a big responsibility. Anyone who takes on a discussion of academic freedom, as you have done this afternoon, and I've been silent until now except for welcoming you, is a gigantic responsibility. I live with it every day. I think that academic freedom, if we don't protect it, we will lose it. If we think of it too broadly, we will confuse it with democracy and democratic rights. If we think of it too narrowly, we may exclude people who legitimately have to have their rights and interests protected. We have, I think, a problem to solve. I'm not exactly sure yet what it is, but I think we have to continue this discussion. I don't think the main event is about an external or an internal statement on academic freedom, because I think we heard very clearly that some of the things we have to be concerned about are not the words on the paper. Places that have strong academic freedom statements have often run into trouble in terms of their implementation strategies. What we need to make sure is that we feel comfortable that we have mechanisms in place to protect academic freedom, to make sure it works in the context in which we actually live, because specificity in its operationalization and the mechanisms that need to be employed are extremely important. There have to be next steps from this. I hope that those of you who have spent the whole afternoon here and those of you who have visited can maintain a strong enough interest to make sure that we can continue to have this conversation and to move this discussion forward. My answer to my colleagues who thought I shouldn't have taken on the responsibility for organizing a conference on academic freedom is it was organized outside of my own personal responsibility. The teams that put it together were people from across the campus. The issues were discussed with the Association of University Teachers of McGill, and we're interested in continuing that kind of a dialogue, because if we don't have collegiality, we wind up having simply conflict, and that's not useful for anyone. I think what we need to do is to figure out how to address these issues in a civil and appropriate way and move to a statement if we think we need it, but make sure that we're vigilant in the way in which we protect academic freedom in the rules and regulations we already have. I started this interest in academic freedom the moment I became the provost because I saw how many rules and regulations we have and how little coherence there was and how little reference there was to the fundamental value that I think we spoke about this afternoon, which is academic freedom. So thank you all very much. I'm standing between you and a glass of wine. Thank you.